Well, good morning.
Good morning.
We are in Genesis 39. I printed off for you the notes that I failed to give you last week, which I apologize about, and that should all be filled in for the stuff that we dealt with in regard to Judah and Tamar. So that's there for you, but we're now looking back to Joseph once again and his life. So we've kind of had this interlude with Joseph's story, then Judah and Tamar, and now back to Joseph again. Of course, the last time we saw Joseph, he's been sent down to Potiphar's house, and he's there, and we haven't heard from him, but we pick up his narrative in beginning in verse number 1. And in this section that I've outlined, chapter 39 through the end of chapter 41, there are three scenes. There's the house of Potiphar. There is the prison for the king's prisoners, and then the court of Pharaoh. Moses offers a key unifying theme in all three scenes, and here it is: God was with Joseph. God was with Joseph. And I've given you the references there that you see that those words are repeated multiple times in this text. You see that in chapter 39 there in verses 2 and 3, 21, 23, and also in chapter 41 several times as well. Now, the significance of God's presence in the accounts is that God was with Joseph even when circumstances seem to be terrible. So he's with him even when circumstances seem to be terrible. So he's a slave. Remember, he's sold into slavery. And even when things seem to be going well for him, Potiphar's wife brings sorrow, yet God was with him. He's in prison for unjust reasons, yet God is with him. In general, as you look at chapters 39 and 40 and 41, here's the basic outline, and this is some of the more famous parts of Joseph's life, so you probably know them well. And Joseph is in Potiphar's house. He prospers there. Potiphar's wife begins to eye him. She attempts to seduce him. He refuses. Potiphar gets word of this. I should back up and say Potiphar's wife accuses him falsely of sexually trying to assault her. And so Potiphar throws Joseph in prison. When he's in prison, Joseph prospers again. He's put in charge of the whole prison. And while he's in charge of the whole prison, there are two key figures that come up in Joseph's life, the king's cupbearer and the king's baker. Both of them have these vivid dreams that Joseph is given a divine interpretation of. To the cupbearer, he's got good news: you're going to be restored to your position. To the chief baker, I've got bad news: off with your head. And that's what happens. The cupbearer is restored. The baker is killed. Joseph pleads with the cupbearer multiple times: please remember me when you're restored to Pharaoh's house. And he doesn't remember until we get to chapter 41, and Pharaoh himself has these vivid dreams. And in these vivid dreams, he demands an interpretation. He can't find anybody in all of his court to find him in interpretations of the dreams. And so he says to anybody, you know, basically, I need help. And the cupbearer goes, oh, yeah, I remember. There was this dude in prison that could interpret these dreams. And Pharaoh says, bring him up. And Joseph interprets the dreams. He is set in charge of all of Pharaoh's kingdom. All right, so those are the basic story plots of those three chapters. Now, in these scenes, though, as you think about God being with Joseph, you notice this letter C, that God's presence and providence join together in this account. And Joseph recognizes this multiple times during this entire exchange. Joseph brings the name of God into all of the events that he was facing. And we think about the presence and the providence joining together, we recognize that there are a whole series of events. If any one of them had changed, the outcome for God's people, and not only God's people, but the whole known world would have been radically reshaped. So, if Joseph had not been sold as a slave, he would have never been in Potiphar's house. If Potiphar's wife hadn't falsely accused him, he wouldn't have been in prison. If Joseph had been released immediately after the king's cupbearer had been restored to Pharaoh's court, Joseph would not have easily been found to interpret Pharaoh's dreams. Though each of these accounts are distinct, they are weaved together to show how God worked in Joseph's life for good, even when circumstances appeared to be sorrowful. And that makes Joseph's life really some of the most meaningful and immediately apparent in terms of its meaning and significance for our lives. You just can't help but read through these accounts and just think, praise God that he works. And oftentimes in my life when I think, boy, God seems, you know, far away and distant, we recognize that he has plans that are bigger than us. You know, we sometimes sing that hymn, God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. It's an old hymn, but we sing that because it reminds us that even when we look at things that are terrible, God has providentially working through them. So God's presence and providence joined together in this account. And that's important, by the way, because God was with Joseph even when it was bad. God was with Joseph even when it was bad. You know, there's this temptation to think that if you are going through a difficulty, whether it is with yourself physically, relationally, financially, economically, your job, social status, the temptation is to think, is God, why are you so far from me right now? But he isn't. He's not. And this is a good reminder of that. So those are the general themes of these chapters. Well, let's get to some more of the specifics. In chapter 39, in the first 20 verses there, we have Joseph in Potiphar's house. Now, Potiphar, who we don't know a lot about, is identified as an officer in Pharaoh's court and also captain of the guard. This, by the way, verse 1 presents a strong link with Genesis 37:36. The link demonstrates that the account of Judah and Tamar is not an imposition in the text. It's not an interruption, in other words, but rather forms a contrast between Judah and Joseph. And the contrast is pretty clear, right? Because Judah, he goes down to Tamar. How long did it take him to fall prey to temptation of a prostitute? Not long at all. You know, his friend said, hey, here's a girl, and he said, sure. Joseph, on the other hand, endures daily this temptation, this onslaught. So we have a great contrast between the two. And I bring that up because you'll find critical people of the Bible who will suggest that this is the Judah and Tamar story is an evidence that these are really not thoughtful accounts, that things were just dumped in over time and kind of haphazardly added. And I don't think that's the case at all. There are reasons why these accounts are inserted in the middle of Joseph's story. Now, as far as Potiphar goes, it's likely that with such a high position that Potiphar had a vast household and properties. We're not exactly sure what captain of the guard meant. Was that general over all of his armies? Was that the head of Pharaoh's personal security team? There are debates on that. But whatever it would be, you know, to sit in the courtroom of one of the most powerful men on planet Earth was not insignificant. He probably would have been a wealthy man. And that's the impression you get as Joseph runs his household. Now, the fact that God was with Joseph, that allows him to prosper. We also note in verses 5 and 6 that Potiphar was also blessed greatly. And we notice this only after Joseph was raised up to a position of leadership. So it's interesting how it says this. So it was from the time that he made him overseer of his house and all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake, And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and the field. Thus he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. This is, would have been important for the people of Israel, because it confirmed God's promise to Abraham that he would bless those who blessed him. Also, practically, this would have been a great time for Joseph to gain administrative skills, which he was going to need really fast, as he would, in a relatively short amount period of time, as he was elevated over essentially all of Egypt. So this God was working. And that's interesting, by the way, isn't it, that you think about that, that he gets in this place he obviously doesn't want to be. We're going to see that later, that he weeps multiple times when he encounters his brothers. The hurt of this doesn't just go away, that he's sold into slavery. But even in the midst of that, here Joseph is actually, under God's providential hand, gaining skills that he would need later in life. So sometimes we think, though, this is really hard, or I don't really like what I'm doing here right now. And oftentimes God's using that for different things and different purposes later in our lives. Verse number 6 says that Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. This is an interesting phrase. The only other time this phrase is used in the Old Testament is actually with his mother Rachel in Genesis 29:17. And the connection there just indicates that, there's a tie to the family here. And Rachel apparently was very beautiful, and Joseph was good-looking himself. Well, that attracted Potiphar's wife. Potiphar's wife attempts to seduce Joseph. And humanly speaking, if you think about this account, Joseph had every excuse to yield to the advances of Potiphar's wife. It was her idea, it's not his. He was a slave who normally had to obey his master. And, Egyptian culture, we have less certainty on this. We do know that, for instance, in Roman culture and the Greek culture, that it was not uncommon for owners to have relations with their slaves. And that really put slaves in an awkward position. When do you say no? When do you not? There were benefits to going along with that. So this was not unthinkable in high society. That's possible that, this would have been not all that unexpected in that day. We can't say for sure. We do know that with other cultures. And even today, you think about it, rich people often have easy access for these kind of things to people underneath them. It's just not unheard of, We can think of presidents, we can think of CEOs, we can think of, rich and wealthy people. So in other words, this would have been an easy one for Joseph just to give in on. Furthermore, nobody's in sight to report him to Potiphar. He's far from his family with its morals. So God had forsaken him, right? At least you could have thought that. So let's just give in. And Joseph's response is so powerful. There are so many lessons that come out of this as we think about temptation of any kind, but especially this area of sexual purity. Joseph's response is threefold. First, Potiphar had given him charge of everything. Second, the only thing that he had not given Joseph was his wife. And third, it would have been wicked before God. And that's what he told Potiphar's wife. So God had blessed him immensely. And we need to note that this was not a one-time event by Potiphar's wife. She continued daily to try to seduce him. And of course, the end of the story. In the end, after Joseph flees from her presence, she falsely accuses of him sin he did not commit. And I'll just say, in our own cultural moment, the whole Me Too thing has died down. Me Too was, I think, in many ways, an important thing to recognize that sexual exploitation happens a lot in our society. Having said that, just because someone says something doesn't make it automatically true. So there are two things to balance out there that you actually have to wrestle through. And here's a perfect example. Remember the phrase for a while was believe women. And you do want to add after the end of that, like, all of them? You know, like, that's not always true, all right? So that takes wisdom and discernment to think through these things. So that's hard. Those are hard issues because abuse does happen. But clearly, Joseph was righteous in this. And I suspect my read of Potiphar's response to all of this is that Potiphar also had doubts about his wife's story. And we'll see that here. We're told in verse 19 when Potiphar heard about this that he's angry. And so it says it this way. So it was when his master heard the words which his wife spoke to him, saying, "Your servant did to me after this matter," that his anger was aroused. But you notice in the text that it does not actually say what he was angry about and who his anger was directed toward. The reason I point that out is that Joseph is not executed, which would have been not a problem for Egyptians and their slaves. Instead, Joseph was placed in the prison, and more specifically in the king's prison, which probably was not the worst of all places. In other words, this wasn't the poor man's prison. This is where the king's problematic people were placed for a time as things were tried to be adjudicated. I'm not saying it was all beautiful and wonderful and life was rich and lavish in the prison, but it is interesting that Potiphar puts him there. And that tells me that I think Potiphar suspected that what Joseph was saying was true. Just Potiphar had to save face. You can't have being the captain of the guard in the king's court, the thing going around saying, "Oh, your wife is trying to sleep with other men." That just isn't going to go well for you, for your image in the court of a powerful king. So more than likely, I think that Potiphar recognized that Joseph was telling the truth. And as I mentioned earlier, the contrast between Joseph and Judah cannot be more clear. Joseph was faithful despite daily pressure, and Judah indulged in sinful behavior. So Joseph was faithful despite daily pressure. Judah indulged in sinful behavior. Well, now we meet Joseph in prison, and that's chapter 39, verses 21 into chapter 40, to the end of the chapter. In verses 21 through 23, at the end of chapter 39, Joseph is introduced in terms of his role in prison. The descriptions of Joseph's life there find parallels with Joseph's time in Potiphar's house. We're told once again that the Lord is with him. We're told also that Joseph found favor with his master or keeper of the prison. You can see that both of these places, these are true in both Potiphar's house and the prison. All Potiphar owned and all the prisoners were under Joseph. And Potiphar and the keeper of the prison didn't have to oversee anything because of Joseph's faithfulness. Also, Potiphar and the keeper of the prison saw that the Lord was with him. And that is interesting that they both recognized that God was with Joseph. And in both places, the Lord made everything he did prosper. And I'll just pause and say here, and we'll come back to this a little bit more when we get to Joseph as he's in the court of Pharaoh and becomes second in command. You have to think about not only for reading it through our eyes today, but let's read it through the eyes of the people of Israel as they first receive this coming out of Egypt. Okay? You have just spent the last 40 years wandering through the wilderness, and you're about to cross over into the promised land. Okay? And Egypt offered, one thing it did offer for the people was some measure of security and stability. And so you're wondering, you know, here we are jumping, we're about to jump over the Jordan, what's this really going to be like? And this idea of God being with his people, even in lands that weren't necessarily theirs, even Canaan wouldn't be theirs till they took possession of it, would have been really important to them. That the Lord was with Joseph, and if the Lord was with Joseph, and the Lord was with, you know, Jacob and the brothers, the Lord can be with us as well. So this would have been an encouraging thing. Now, as I mentioned earlier, Joseph here encounters two more officials connected with Pharaoh. Now, that's going to be three, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker. Both have these vivid dreams that Joseph interprets. You can read about them in Genesis 39. But we do need to say this, that this is, note that this is a descriptive passage of Scripture that does not instruct us today to interpret dreams. So it's a descriptive passage of Scripture. And more important theologically, Joseph identifies God as the one who holds the interpretation of dreams in verse 8. Furthermore, by the way, I'll just say that if you look in Hebrews 1, this is a text, and there's several like it in the Old Testament, that, and even some in the New, that people point to say, hey, we should be trying to discern the meaning of our dreams today. You'll read Hebrews 1, and it says, God, who in times past has revealed to us through prophets and visions and all these things, but now he has spoken through his Son. All right? So don't read this text of Scripture thinking in any way that this gives us rights to interpret our dreams. Could God work through dreams? Sure. But that is not the expectation that the New Testament gives for us today. So that was for free. All right. Letter C. Joseph, you know, he interprets the dreams, and what happens comes to pass exactly as Joseph had said. Joseph pled with the cupbearer to remember him four times in verse 14. I mean, he really pressed this home to the cupbearer. So you read this in chapter 40 and verse number 14. I was looking in the wrong verse there. But remember me when it is well with you, and please show kindness to me. Make mention of me and get me out of this house. So, you know, four times in different ways. Please, 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 please. And yet the cupbearer forgot. You know, who knows what... That blows my mind every time I read this text. Like, how could you just ignore that and not remember that? That had to have been significant. But, you know, in the providence of God, God knew the right time to have that revealed. Well, we leave Joseph sitting there in prison while the keeper of the prison has put him in charge of everything. The chief butler has not remembered Joseph. He's completely forgotten him. And then we pick it up in chapter 41 and verse number 1 that we're told that 2 years have passed. 2 years have passed. That's a long time. Like, you just think about that. Have you ever been through one of those seasons of life where it's like months of difficulty? 2 years? That is a long time. And of course, that's only the kind of the tip of the iceberg for Joseph, how long it is. We'll talk about how long he's been in Egypt in just a couple of moments. So God's timetable is God's timetable is often not our timetable. Now, Pharaoh also has two dreams. I mentioned this last week, but it is interesting that every time we see Joseph with dreams, they're in pairs. He had two as a young man. He interprets two in the prison, and now Pharaoh has two. I'm not sure what that means other than it shows unity in God's working in this, but it just is an interesting thing of note. There are people who speculate on that. But in general, it reiterates that the account, the narrative here is unified, and God's plan here is unified in Joseph's life. And he has these two dreams. One is, of course, of the cows near the Nile River, and the other is of the stalks and heads of grain. Pharaoh is said to be troubled by these dreams in verse number 8. Now, it came to pass in the morning that his spirit was troubled. He sent for all the magicians of Egypt and all the wise men. So he's troubled. The only other time this word is used in the Old Testament is Daniel 2, verse 3, where Nebuchadnezzar was troubled by a dream. That's just interesting, by the way. Two powerful kings have these kind of dreams. And so that indicates that these were no ordinary dreams. They're no ordinary dreams. Of course, you know the account. When nobody can interpret the dream, the cupbearer reminds Joseph and informs Pharaoh of him. Joseph is shaved and brought into Pharaoh's court. Joseph is shaved and brought into Pharaoh's court. He, you wonder why that is. Well, you think about, you can think about even movies and depictions of ancient Egypt. You know, you always have men who are clean shaven. That was just the norm for them. The Hebrews, on the other hand, they often had beards. You even see that in the Old Testament, the reference to people's beards as a big deal. And so, it would have been offensive to bring him into the court like that. So they clean him up, they bathe him, polish him up. I'm sure that was a quick job, but not exactly particularly comfortable. He's rushed in, probably relatively early in the morning to Pharaoh's court. And that in and of itself, we read these accounts, and we do need to read a little bit between the lines and just think about the utter chaos that would have been in Joseph's mind. I don't have an experience anywhere close to that. I've had a few times where I've sat down with somebody for a meeting and got totally blindsided by something I just did not see coming. Right, so that happens, but that just pales in comparison to this. Even if you were right now, all of a sudden, got a phone call and within 3 minutes, two black SUVs pull up here with people who are part of the Secret Service and say, "Would you come with me?" And they stick you on a plane and they drop you off at the White House lawn, and you walk into President Trump, who says, "I have a big problem and you're the only one who can solve it." Even that isn't quite the same, because, President Trump actually has great power. Any president does, but it's limited power. The Pharaoh wasn't like that. He wasn't quite a dictator, but his power is immense. Whatever he said, that's what happened. And so you just imagine that, you don't even know what's coming, right? You don't get a briefing on the plane over. You're brought in and says, "Okay, I hear you can interpret dreams." Done it twice in my life, okay, so here's my dreams. Tell me what they mean. The terror of that would have been unbelievable. But God was with him there. God was with him there. And you see that. And Joseph credits God in his ability to interpret dreams. And Pharaoh himself and also Pharaoh's court recognize this ability. Well, Joseph is elevated to the highest position in Pharaoh's court in all of Egypt. And there is a question that arises in people's minds when they read through this narrative, how in the world could it be that someone who was literally in prison that morning is now elevated to be the number two guy, basically not only in that country, but at that time in the most powerful nation on planet Earth? How could that happen? Well, we know theologically it's because God was in this, but there are several possible explanations. One that I think is very plausible is that Pharaoh had been concerned about intrigue in his court. Remember, who are the two guys that are sitting in prison? It's the chief baker and the chief butler, the cupbearer. All right? More than likely, they're in prison not because that they made just a meal that didn't taste good. All right? More than likely, they're in prison because Pharaoh had been concerned about plots against his life. It takes a really, really ruthless dictator to just go kill someone because they made a meal that was just a little subpar that day. So that's really unlikely of the scenario as to why the baker had his life taken. Probably there were people that were a threat to Pharaoh, as there is in any big, powerful nation. And that's why we have to have things like the Secret Service to protect a president. Because there are people who do crazy things and want to take power. Coups happen. You live long enough, you're going to see that multiple times around the world. These things happen. So it's likely that there were a lot of concerns about for Pharaoh's life. So Pharaoh may have wanted someone outside of his court whom he could trust. And furthermore, Joseph does have two very important people who are vouching for his life. He's got the captain of the guard. Potiphar isn't mentioned here, but it's likely he's still in the court. And Potiphar could have said to him, "Look, This guy's a trustworthy guy. Why did you put him in prison? It's kind of shady, but here's the details. You know, I don't really want that spread around, but, you know, and the keeper of the prison could go like, this guy was an administrative genius. He worked so hard. Everything he did was good. And so, plus he interpreted these dreams, and he did so with confidence. So it's all of that is a very plausible explanation that Pharaoh said, I need someone who I can trust that isn't part of this inner ring who, you know, I don't know who is making attempts on my life. But one way or another, stunningly, Joseph is now one of the most powerful people in Egypt, but also in the world. And according to verse number 46, Joseph is a mere 30 years old. And this gives us an exact timetable for all of the events from when he was sold into slavery to this point. He was 17 when he entered Egypt. So what we read in chapters 39 through 41 covers a 13-year period. Now, again, that is a long time to languish like that. All right, so we just need to put that in perspective. You know, you all came out and celebrated 20 years for me and for Casey last Sunday night. We really appreciate that. It was a great, great blessing to our hearts. You know, and that just causes you to do things like reminisce. You know, you think about all the stuff that happens over 20 years. And so much of it sweet and good and fun and sometimes stupid, like why in the world did I do that? You know, there, all of those things come rushing back through you. And you just start doing the you know, like, wow, this happened and this happened and this happened and this happened and this happened. And, you know, 20 years is a long time. 13 years is a long time. That is a long time in his life. And again, as I said earlier, that just indicates that God's timetable is not our timetable. So we read about his life here at this point. He's now just launched into this exalted position. And we should note that along the way, God has been preparing for this. All right? If you're number two in charge, that doesn't mean that your life is now easy. It just means you have an immense amount of responsibility. And I'll just say this generally to people. I've said this before, but you know, if you're not in management of anything, be really cautious of being critical of managers. You know, there are bad managers. There are bad bosses. There's no doubt about that. That happens. But the kind of people who are lifted up to those positions have immense amounts of responsibilities put up under them. And the further up the chain you go, the more pressure that gets. And yet, you think about all of the experiences that Joseph had been through, really prepared him for that. You know, in Potiphar's house, he would have learned a lot about courtroom attire policies. He would have done the same thing in the king's prison. I mean, he would have met a lot of people that would have been connected with Pharaoh. And so those were important things and skills that he would have learned. So God was with him in all that. We do learn at the end of chapter 41 that Joseph is given a wife, a new name, and has two sons. Now that transformation is helpful information because it helps us understand why the brothers, they don't recognize Joseph. He has been shaved, whereas Hebrews had usually had beards. He's given Egyptian clothes. He's given an Egyptian name, has an Egyptian wife. And thus, he appeared to be fully assimilated in Egyptian life. Fully assimilated in Egyptian life. By the end of the chapter, we find out that Joseph's leadership was effective. All the countries surrounding Egypt came to Egypt and Joseph to gain food. Well, let's start a little bit with the brothers and their first trip to Egypt. The brothers and their first trip to Egypt. This occurs in chapter 42 all the way through the end of chapter 45. And we won't get through all of this here this morning, but we'll at least touch base and get ourselves started. And these stories, this part of Genesis, I think, is this whole narrative of Joseph's life is really the easiest to read in many ways. There's not a lot of explanation that needs to happen. There are a few points along the way. This chapter opens with Jacob sending his sons to Egypt, like everyone else, to obtain grain. Jacob. I don't know where that came from. All right. So opens with Jacob sending his sons to Egypt to obtain grain. Now, verse number 4, these next couple of chapters are sad commentaries on Jacob in many ways. It says this, but Jacob did not send his brother, Joseph's brother Benjamin, with his brothers, for he said, lest some calamity befall him. And he's thinking in terms of Joseph as well. And that indicates that the family troubles had not fully healed. Jacob is still unwilling to send Benjamin, who was the second of Rachel's children. Jacob's favoritism is displayed once again. Now, the brothers are going to respond in righteousness to that, but the tensions are still there. You know the account. They show up there to Joseph. They ask for grain. They ask for food. And they bow down before Joseph. And Joseph remembers the dreams that he had as a young man. Remembers the dreams.
Jacob might have had some suspicion that his sons might have done something, since he's not sending his Benjamin.
Yeah, so the question is, do you think that Jacob might have had some suspicion of his sons?
Yeah, I don't think he trusted them completely.
We don't see any direct evidence of that one way or the other. It's possible. It's possible. But, of course, the son's explanation was that they found, remember, his coat on the way to meeting him. So there was never, in their story, there was never a time where Joseph was with them. Remember, they took the coat and they rubbed goat blood all over it and, you know, tore it up a little bit. So that's really hard to say for certain. It is clear that he doesn't trust his sons, because Reuben is going to say, you can kill my first two born if I don't bring Benjamin back alive. And later Judah is going to say, I'm a personal pledge, my life for his, if we don't bring Benjamin back alive. So he doesn't trust his sons in that sense, but whether that's because he suspected them, I don't know. It could be. It's also really sad, and we'll see this later in the notes, that Jacob doesn't really even seem to care about Simeon languishing in prison. Now, he wasn't in prison, we find out later, but the brothers don't know that. He was treated apparently pretty well. So Jacob doesn't even seem to care about one of his sons languishing in prison. He's just more concerned about this son. And I just think that indicates that the family tensions hadn't... I mean, that had to have been irritating to the other brothers. So I don't know how to answer that question definitively. John, I saw the hand in the back. Oh, Todd, yeah.
I think it's pretty clear that he hasn't lost his personal favorites problem. And what is interesting, though, is the other brothers have grown through this a bit anyway.
Yeah. We're going to highlight that a number of times in these next chapters, where they grow and they mature through this. So God uses this even in their lives as well. So, I don't know. That's a long answer to say I'm not sure. But it's possible. It's possible. Now, Joseph, as he meets his brothers, he approaches them with a rather harsh tone. He speaks with them, you know, in a way that doesn't make them feel good. They note it. They pick up on it right away. And somehow or another, I'm missing an entire page of notes, which is okay, because we're about done anyways. All right. So why was this? Moses doesn't explain it. However, it is probable that he wanted to see if they had changed, and therefore it was a test. It was a test. And this test allowed Joseph to see if his brother Benjamin was alive and whether they would abandon a brother like he was abandoned. This is going to show up perfectly in Joseph's life. So this, again, is another providential thing that God uses, even, I think, Jacob's poor decisions to bring about a good end, which you just see all the way through this, both natural, God's in control of the weather, but natural disaster and also family disaster. God works through all of that to bring about his sovereign will. It's also, it's really a heart-wrenching commentary on the brothers in verse 21 that they're distressed when Joseph starts talking to him this way. They don't know who he is. So they say to one another, "We are truly guilty concerning our brother, for we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not hear. Therefore, this distress has come upon us." That's an insight. You remember that he's sitting there in the pit, and obviously they heard him crying out to them. And so that's one of those moments where you just think about it on a human level, that the reality of that was still ringing in their ears 13 years later. And it's interesting that as soon as anything bad happened in their life, that was brought up. The Lord is revisiting vengeance upon us for that. Now, we think about Joseph's anguish for 13 years. We also see that these brothers have anguish for 13 years. I mean, the guilt of that had to have been strong. And it's obvious here that it was. So, guilt continues to remain. All right, we'll stop right there and we'll continue on next time, partly because I don't have any more notes. I don't remember what comes next because somehow I'm missing between my page 88 and 80 to 90. You're a different page pagination than yours, and plus I'm over time anyway. So, yes?
I miss 4D.
4D. Where am I looking at?
Bottom of 67, last blank.
Bottom of... Is this under Joseph's rises in Pharaoh's court?
Yeah.
See, I must have deleted something. Can I see your notes for a second? Because... Yeah, I must have copied and pasted and deleted that section out of mine. I'll have to get back to you on that. I don't remember the exact wording so that it's supposed to be. All right, on that sorry note, you are dismissed.